Over the past 250 years, the United States has rejected kings, survived civil war,
the Eagle has landed,
landed humans on the moon, and became the most influential power of the modern age. But the story is one of contradictions, a history scarred by slavery, the dispossession and massacre of indigenous peoples, racial segregation, and deep political division. In the darkest days of the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln called for a new birth of freedom. A century later, civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. reminded the nation that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. The country's greatest strength may be that it has never stopped arguing over what America should be. Perhaps that is its defining achievement. Not perfection, but progress. A republic that has repeatedly challenged itself and expanded the meaning of freedom. Not a finished republic, but one still striving to live up to its founding ideals. So as the nation marks this historic anniversary, does it have more to celebrate than regret? The argument from one prominent American critic is that unchecked corporate power, endless war, inequality, and fierce political polarization have profoundly weakened that democratic experiment. As an ordained Presbyterian minister, former foreign correspondent, and the author of Empire of Illusion and America, the Farewell Tour, he sees a nation facing an existential crisis. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and commentator Chris Hedges talks to Al Jazeera. Chris Hedges, a very, very warm welcome to Talks at Al Jazeera. You've said in several discussions in the past that asking the right question is essential to finding the truth. I wonder what questions you hope Americans are asking of themselves and their country on this anniversary.
They're not asking the right questions, which is what happened to our country. We still imbibe, I think this is as true for the left as the right, on the myth of America, that somehow we live in a democracy, that somehow our democratic institutions function. As you know, I spent 20 years overseas covering all sorts of dictatorships from Augusto Pinochet's Chile to Saddam Hussein's Iraq, so perhaps it's easier for me to see the signs. But it's over. The impediments to an authoritarian state no longer exist. And they're not confronting that reality.
Okay, Chris, I mean, the First Amendment guarantees the freedom to question power without fear. I mean, do you believe that that principle, it sounds like you don't believe this, but in any way is being upheld here in the United States?
Well, the process of consolidating a dictatorship is not instantaneous. First, you hollow out the institutions, which is what neoliberalism, or let's call it by its more proper name, cutthroat capitalism, did. So Trump is the symptom. He's not the disease. He's what comes when a restive population begins to realize they've been conned, they've been fleeced. 30 million Americans lost their jobs in mass layoffs because of deindustrialization. This was a bipartisan project. The capturing of the courts, we see it with the removal of federal judges, we see it with the Supreme Court, probably the most reactionary court in American history. We see it with the shutting down of free speech on college campuses. Of course, I'm talking about the encampments that questioned the genocide, the not just the suspension and expulsion of students, but even professors. So the walls are clearly closing in.
Chris, let's circle back to the issue of freedom of speech, because your detractors would say that a truly autocratic state doesn't let an articulate critic like yourself, for instance, you know, monetize that criticism on Substack, for instance. I mean, there's a difference between a flawed democracy, which is what you appear to be describing, and an autocratic state, surely.
But I'm describing a process, so I we're not there yet. We're moving very quickly in that direction. You know, it's with the flick of a switch, you can create civic death. By that, I mean you demonetize. That's what happened to Julian Assange. Julian Assange is in Sweden, and suddenly his bank account is frozen. His ATM cards don't work. So there already is a policing. And we see that with the shadow banning, with the control of the consolidation of social media platforms and the fusion of those platforms with a security and surveillance state.
Well, let's move away, though, from media ownership, because I want to say focused on the foundational core here, Chris. Is the text of the First Amendment itself, is the text failing, or are people failing to use the power embedded within that text, you think?
No, what's failed is the mechanism, the judicial mechanisms by which free speech was once upheld. I mean, for instance, there was an article in the New York Times the other day, front page story, about all of the machinations the Trump White House is using to fix the midterm elections. But let's say the Democrats win. Who's going to enforce if there's some kind of an impeachment, if Trump is held accountable under the Emoluments Clause? So the problem is the enforcement mechanism, and the last readout that those of us who care about an open society have is the judicial system, and that is becoming rapidly reconfigured. Again, that follows a pattern in many of the countries that I reported from.
Chris, I was taken by something else you've been talking about very widely that's pertinent, perhaps, to these 4th of July celebrations. You've suggested that American society has increasingly substituted spectacle for reality and is experiencing deep structural decline. You've already touched upon that. Can you help us understand what you mean by that? The whole idea of spectacle for reality.
Right. So let's take the Democratic Party, for instance. The Democratic Party does not function as a traditional political party. Its base has absolutely no say in what the hierarchy. Well, first of all, Biden, remember, never ran against an opponent in the primaries. Then when they realized they were going to get shellacked, he was summarily removed, and Kamala Harris was anointed. Nobody voted for her. 77% of Democrats oppose weapon shipments to Israel to stop the genocide. It doesn't matter. And so that's what I mean by spectacle. You have political parties that function as spectacle. The same is true with the Republican Party under Trump, which functions now primarily as a cult.
Do you see the 4th of July celebrations themselves as an extension of that spectacle? Somehow a way of distracting the population from the ills within?
No, because of course what happened is you had a bipartisan commission that was overseeing the 250th anniversary, and this got hijacked by Trump. So it became it didn't become a spectacle by which we would honor the country or the values of the country such as they are, but it became a kind of vanity project for the Trump White House. Well, that, of course, only fosters or widens the divisions within the society and alienates roughly half the population that detests Trump.
You clearly are not letting the entire political establishment off the hook. But, I mean, let's move beyond the fact that this is just a Trumpian spectacle. Because are we missing the point when we attach such a profound critique of America right now on one man?
Well, I don't have my critique on one man. I mean, I think if Trump disappeared tomorrow, we would still, somebody else would take his place. That what we saw, and I wrote a book probably at this point almost two decades ago, called American Fascist, the Christian Right, and the War on America. I was inside these megachurches. I spent 2 years on it. And I watched how these megapastors preyed on the despair of Americans who had been disenfranchised or dispossessed within their own country. So the conclusion of that book was, we're not going to argue people out of magical thinking. We're not going to argue them out of creationism. We've got to re-enfranchise them economically back into the society.
Chris, there's a lot of deconstruction here, but I feel like we need to find a little bit to construct some hope from. I mean, it's all good and well to suppose diagnose the rot, but where are the solutions here? And I'm keen to focus on the American Constitution and its capacity potentially to self-correct, because you argue that real progress only comes from radical movements like abolitionists, like the US Civil Rights Movement. But is it fair to say that those movements succeed here in the US because the founding fathers created institutions that have given rise to abolition, civil rights? What I'm saying is, did they create the bedrock by which the nation can perpetually self-correct as it goes along?
No. They created a nation that was the exclusive domain of white male slaveholders. Remember, it just wasn't women African Americans, Native Americans who were disenfranchised, but men without property. Originally, the Senate, senators were appointed because they pass most of the legislation. They're in for longer terms. And you go back to the Federalist Papers, and there was a real fear of popular democracy. And that's what they were pushing against, that Thomas Paine type democracy.
You're describing a kind of 18th century oligarchy. I wonder then why grassroots civil rights movements like No Kings are using language taken straight from the Declaration.
Well, they use the language, but the that all men are created equal when it was written was just factually not correct. If you were an African American, you were not created equal. If you were a Native American, you were not created equal. So, yes, they're using the language to essentially turn it on itself. That's what Martin Luther King did very, very well. But all of the openings of American democracy, Howard Zinn writes about this in A People's History of the United States, came from movements. And remember, the United States, in terms of the labor movement, we had the bloodiest labor wars of any industrialized country. Hundreds of American workers were killed. Tens of thousands were blacklisted. So those openings came from the abolitionists, from the suffragists, but they fought against the system. And now the system, which has done a very good job in this kind of a reaction to the rise of popular movements in the 1970s, you get the Powell Memo of 1971, they rolled everything backwards, and in particular unions, because only about 10% of the American workforce is unionized. And about 6% of that are public sector employees who are denied the right to strike, which is, of course, is the one weapon that workers have to push back against the machinery of government and commerce.
And you clearly don't believe that in any way the establishment was designed to correct itself as time goes by. And I guess one very obvious way in which that starkly presents itself in modern America is when it comes to gun ownership. Of course, the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. There are 500 to 700 mass shootings a year. The vast majority of Americans, we understand, would prefer sensible gun ownership laws. I mean, I suppose if a 250-year-old document can't protect the lives of children, what can it do?
Well, I mean, the document itself is an ideal. But, I mean, for instance, the right to privacy, we lost that a long time ago. Edward Snowden exposed the fact that we're the most monitored, watched, photographed, surveilled population in human history. And I covered the Stasi state in East Germany. But you know, as someone who comes from Britain, that you had a mass shooting and the state responded rationally. I think it was a school shooting even.
Dunblane.
Exactly. Yes, yeah. And they imposed, gun laws that essentially, but we can't do that. And that gets into the kind of paralysis. I mean, most Americans want big banks regulated. Most Americans, and we're talking about, these are majoritarian sentiments. They want Medicare for all, as the Brits have with the National Health Service, or the Canadians have. But that gets into the kind of calcification or the stagnation, whatever you want to call it, of the political elite that no longer responds under neoliberalism to the populace, but caters to an oligarchic and corporate class that has reconfigured the economy to funnel wealth upwards. And that's how you get figures like Elon Musk being worth $1 trillion. I don't know, you'd probably have to go back to the time of the pharaohs or something to find this disparity in terms of social equality.
Let's talk war, something you know intimately. I mean, you won a Pulitzer Prize reporting on the horrors of war. Now, of course, following the US-Iran war, we appear to be sliding into a more fractured, multipolar world. I mean, if the US goes ahead, for whatever reason, in slashing its military footprint in the Middle East, in retreating, as you advocate, I understand, I mean, doesn't that leave a massive, potentially bloody vacuum in the world?
No, I think if you look at the last three decades in the Middle East, the extension or the footprint of the American military has created instability, not to mention tremendous suffering in countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, and now Iran. But declining empires engage in military adventurism. I studied classics. That's what the Athenian Empire did. That's what the Roman Empire did. They engage in military adventurism, foolish military adventurism, to try and recapture a lost hegemony, and that's precisely what the United States is doing, and Trump isn't the first to do it. I mean, the Republicans and Democrats did that with Iraq. They did that with Afghanistan. But unfortunately, there's no self-corrective process. Those who orchestrated and oversaw those debacles are not held to account. The way you could say did happen after the Vietnam War, that these people are still in power. The neocons who pushed these wars are still on the cable news networks and still in their think tanks, even though they've just led us from disaster to disaster.
As a classicist, you'll know, of course, Xi Jinping mentioned the Thucydides trap recently.
Right.
You know, this whole concept of a declining power clashing against an emerging power, that it is a historical inevitability, as we saw between Sparta and the Athenians in ancient times. If America steps back, don't you trigger that trap? I mean, don't you hand Taiwan to China? Do you not hand Eastern Europe to Russia?
No, because I think there was a historical process whereby a series of bad judgments create. I mean, you know, just as the slaughter of the Palestinians, it did not begin, you know, we can't begin history on October 7th. You have to look at the expansion of NATO. You know, I was in East Germany for the unification of Germany, and I was there when the German foreign minister, Hans-Dietrich Genscher and James Baker, promised Gorbachev, because people forget Germany was not allowed to be unified unless it had the unless it was approved by the Soviet Union, and the deal was we will not expand NATO beyond the borders of a unified Germany. This was ignored. I'm not excusing what Putin did. It was a war crime without question. I mean, on the other hand, he was baited and provoked. And this again gets into the and a lot of it has to do with the atrophication of American diplomacy, the ascendancy, even when I was overseas, of intelligence agencies and the military. You know, empires or nations need astute diplomats, and we've eviscerated ours, and that leads to a lot of decisions that have terrible consequences. The invasion of Iraq, attempt to occupy Iraq, Afghanistan, the debacle in Libya, and now Iran. This is been carried out by people who can't read their adversaries, much less their friends.
I mean, NATO, Chris, I mean, aggressively denies a plan to encircle Russia. I remember back in the day when I was covering NATO in Brussels and the old headquarters, when the NATO-Russia Council existed, when Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, would sit down around a round table and talk constructively with NATO alliance members. There was a hope that potentially even one day Russia might be part
Gorbachev
of NATO.
Gorbachev wanted to join NATO. And I think that was part of the folly or the hubris of American empire. Well, you can say there was no plan to encircle Russia, but in fact, they extended NATO right up to Russia's borders. And, you know, there is historical trauma there. You know, I know you know, because you spent a lot of time in Russia. Three times the Russians were invaded, once by Napoleon, twice in the 20th century after the First World War, and then, of course, through Ukraine. So there was no reason for it. It was just, again, another miscalculation on the part of empire. And again, I don't in any way want to excuse the Russian atrocities in Ukraine, which are very real. So this is what happens when you have tremendous military power, which the United States has, wedded to idiocy. And that really explains what happened in Iran. I spent a lot of time in Iran. I covered it. This was completely predictable. Of course they were going to shut down the Strait of Hormuz. Mm.
Let me ask you this and play devil's advocate, because people watching this interview will say, well, look, Chris is advocating for a global hegemony run by Beijing or Moscow. Why is that preferable to it being run by Washington,
D.C.?
Well,
no, I'm not advocating that. I mean, a multipolar world is one where competing powers have to take into consideration the spheres of influence that other powers have. The United States has certainly, since the end of the Cold War, decided that it can do whatever it wants, wherever it wants, and certainly within the Middle East alone. This has proved detrimental to stability. I mean, you know, I think you can argue that starting with the funding of the resistance movement against the Soviets in Afghanistan, we bear, and this was also true in Syria, and elsewhere, we bear a great deal of responsibility in terms of the rise of these radical jihadist movements.
Let's talk about something light. American capitalism, if we may, because you trace inequality back to the Industrial Revolution and the growth of very powerful corporations. But many Americans, they would say that, look, free markets, they've lifted millions of people out of poverty. Why burn the engine down instead of seeking to regulate it rigorously?
But that's not factually true. I mean, what lifted people out of poverty were unions, especially in the 1930s. The eight-hour workday, the end of child labor, the pensions, Social Security, that came from union activity. It didn't become, we didn't gain these rights or, decent wages because of the beneficence of the capitalist class. It became possible within American society, certainly by the 1950s, as a worker, it's no longer true, to have a middle class life. But that came from unions.
Again, we're going back to this idea of sort of corporate oligarchs. Let's look at the courts, because the Supreme Court stood firm, protected recently birthright citizenship under the 14th Amendment. I mean, if corporate oligarchs fully control the state today, how do you explain a ruling that explicitly protects some of the most marginalized in American society?
That amendment's pretty hard to get around. It's pretty black and white. So I don't know what else the Supreme Court was going to rule on that. On the other hand, they also have further extended the imperial powers of the Trump White House, this kind of unitary executive.
They have, and Donald Trump has had quite a few wins over the past few days. But that particular decision on birthright citizenship, I mean, it's evidence, isn't it? The Constitution still has the capacity to protect people here.
It depends. I mean, again, let's go back to the right to privacy. I mean, it depends what they accept and what they ignore. And Edward Snowden, who essentially sacrificed his existence as an American citizen in order to warn the country in the hopes that there would be some...
He's now a core celebre in Moscow, then.
Well, sure, but he can't come here. And so there you have, I think, a very clear statement by the Constitution that is just blithely ignored because the security surveillance state does not find it convenient.
Chris, I've got a few final questions for you. Firstly, has this... what everyone refers to as the American experiment. Has it succeeded? Has it failed? Is it a work in progress? How would you see it?
I don't think there's any going back at this point. I think that we've undergone, as John Rolston Saul said, a corporate coup d'etat in slow motion. The rapacious effects of neoliberalism, which are global, they're not limited to the United States. The next iteration of neoliberalism is essentially fascism, because you need stronger mechanisms to hold a restive population in check. We see it with ICE. We see it with the building of these detention centers all over the United States. If people think those are only for undocumented workers, they're very, very naive.
I'm curious about those who have put themselves in harm's way to stand against those injustices, ICE, etc. I mean, isn't that absolutely symptomatic of the bedrock of what it means to be American, to stand up against injustice, all of the things that are, from the outset, embedded in the early declarations of the Constitution?
Yes, and look what's happened to them. I mean, they're criminalizing the photographing of ICE abuses. They killed two American citizens on the streets of Minneapolis. They just gave these draconian prison sentences in Texas to these ICE protesters. Up to 30 and 50 years. So we are seeing, the whole criminalization of Antifa. I mean, what is Antifa? It's this amorphous, the demonization of the so-called radical left. So yes, civil disobedience has never been embraced by the ruling elite, but it's been an important part of the American project as expressed by everyone from Frederick Douglass to Thoreau. But you're really seeing a concerted effort, not just to shut down voices, we're seeing that especially over the genocide, but really to physically go after those people who are attempting to push back against this fascist project.
Can you give me one concrete historical model that you would actually replace modern America with if you could?
It's not so much that I would replace modern America with another historical model. I mean, I happen to be a socialist.
Why is socialism, the name socialist, become such a kind of toxic, dirty word from the political right at the moment? It seems to be the best way of unpicking one's opponent, irrespective of whether they are socialist or not.
Yeah, because, again, that gets into the whole, you know, burlesque of the American media system. It's all sound bites. I come out of the traditional media. I spent 15 years at the New York Times. The degradation of the media is quite depressing. It's, trivia and empty and, there's nothing of depth. So socialism, we had many. Social security is socialism. Mm. Universal health care is socialism. The ability of the country to care for the most vulnerable. I mean, when Social Security was put into place, I forget the numbers, but significant numbers of elderly people in this country were literally starving. Mm. The rolling back of those programs, and the capitalist class has made war on those programs almost since their inception.
Another slur that you often hear is to be accused of being unpatriotic. I wonder, can love of country, can patriotism, can it exist at the same time as contempt, criticism of the country's history and its past wrongs?
If you can't criticize the past, if you can't deconstruct the past, then you can't build a better future. So the retreat into myth is, again, the intellectual and spiritual calcification of the society. And it is that ability to constantly re-examine ourselves that allows us to go forward and build a better society. And that's something that all fascist movements seek to shut down.
All nations have founding myths that bring countries together, particularly in times of upheaval, no?
Yes, and they're all untrue. And I think part of the role of an intellectual or a historian is to uncover the truth. And sometimes it takes a very long time. Lynching in the United States would be a pretty good example.
Chris, let me ask you this, of course, on that last point. I mean, if you were standing in a stadium right now, packed to the rafters with the enthusiastic 20-year-olds, what is the single constructive lesson from the last 250 years that you want them to carry forward? Or would you just simply tell everyone to get up and leave?
No, I would say mass movements, organizing through nonviolence to shut down the machinery of commerce and the machinery of state are the one mechanism we have, because we have numbers, by which we can push back against what's happening to us. I'm a strong supporter of Extinction Rebellion. They shut down the M25 motorway for 4 days around London. They got very long, so I guess that was just stop oil.
People want quiet, simple lives. They don't want upheaval staring them in the face, though.
Yes, but, you know, quiet, simple lives at this point are going to mean that by the time we wake up, it's too late.
Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Author, journalist, commentator, Chris Hedges. Thanks for talking to Al Jazeera.
Thank you.